Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
I'm Alok Jha and you're listening to Science Weekly, well, the holiday version. This mini podcast is all about one of our scientific heroes, Charles Darwin. This time we're going to explore Darwin, the man of letters. We're going to begin with the poet Ruth Padell, who's written extensively on Darwin and his ideas.
Charles Darwin wrote an enormous number of words in his life. Many of these are in letters, many of them are in scientific papers, some quite concentrated, real hard-hitting scientific papers. And then his first book was a young man's book, The Voyage of the Beagle. He wrote it as one volume in four for the Admiralty expedition to South America, which took 5 years and was captained by Captain Fitzroy. And it instantly became very popular and got reprinted, actually not with his permission at first. And eventually he took control of it and John Murray helped him. And it was called The Voyage of the Beagle. It's a wonderful read. And anybody who really wants to get to know the writings of Charles Darwin, do start with The Voyage of the Beagle, because it took the public imagination at once. He wanted to write freshly and vividly and personally about what he'd seen, and also, of course, scientifically. His writing style really tells you something about the man himself, which you can see also in his letters, that he passionately was interested in what he was talking about, life. He was interested in life forms of every kind. That word form often comes into his writing. And he's interested in how forms change. That was his big idea. So he wants to communicate this exciting thing to his readers in every way he possibly can, vividly, with images, often with humour and with grace, but also with modesty. He was a very modest person. Charles Darwin's feelings about poetry changed radically through his life. When he was young, he loved poetry. At school, he read Byron, and he also loved the historical plays, particularly the historical plays of Shakespeare. On the Beagle, he took Milton with him, and he loved Paradise Lost. When he sees a lot of phosphorescence in the sea, he says, nobody could look at this, he says, without remembering Milton. And Milton is his constant reference. And he used to slip it in his pocket when he went on land expeditions on the Beagle. When he came back after that, he discovered Wordsworth. He particularly loved those lines in Wordsworth, "Nature never did betray the heart that loves her." But as he went on, he felt that his mind, and it was a source of deep regret to him in later age, that his mind had become hardened to poetry. He said at one point, "My mind has become just a machine for grinding laws out of minute particulars and facts." And he regretted that. He did still have this sense of poetry. When he was working on the insect-eating plants, Drosera, he said with a smile once to his son, you know, he felt he could actually write a poem about Drosera. And I think that shows his engagement with and passion for the subject. I mean, he connected poetry with passion, but he said afterwards, you know, if he'd had his life over again, he wished he would have read a poem every day, and he wished he had not let his mind go to rot so. And what he meant was that he felt that he'd become sort of hardened to poetry, that he couldn't respond to Shakespeare as he had once done. He felt he could respond to landscape in the same way, with the same lift and of sublimity, but not to poetry anymore. And that was a source of grief to him towards old age.
Here's Steve Jones, the University College London biologist, explaining how Darwin got to work with On the Origin of Species. And he also scans through some of the scientist's other great works.
He wrote The Origin a bit like the recent book about this newly discovered fossil, in that he was told to write it within a few months, because, as everybody knows, Alfred Russel Wallace wrote to him from the Far East with roughly the same idea. And this panicked him, because for many years he'd been building up these ideas. He'd written in 1837 that, "At last I have a theory to work with." And he'd worked on the theory for 10, 20 years. And The Origin was a kind of urgent distillation of everything he wanted to say. And many of his other books return to those themes and deal with them in sometimes excruciating detail. For example, chapter one of The Origin is called Variation Under Domestication. It's about dogs and pigeons and flowers in the garden. Then he wrote two solid works of 500 pages each called Variation Under Domestication, in which we go through the sheep, the goat, the pig, the hen, you know, the chicken, the duck, many plants, and he just goes back and back and back and back and just fires off his heavy artillery again and again. And they're much more scientific and technical works, and I have to say I've read them. or to be more accurate, I flip through them. And those, many of those, I wouldn't recommend reading for pleasure. I would read The Expression of the Emotions book for pleasure, simply because it's so terminally weird and so terminally ahead of its time. It was the first ever book, scientific book, to have photographs in it. The first published book to have photographs in it was by Darwin. Who knows that? And the photographs are astounding. They're pictures of a man of reduced intellect, in other words, somebody who's pretty dim, having electric probes put onto his face to see if he can simulate looks of horror and amusement and terror, and they do it quite successfully. And that's a good read. And the other one that's a good read, surprisingly, is the Earthworm's book. And that's his very last book. He died a year or so after it was finished. And as he says, you know, earthworms formed history. The whole of the English landscape has passed through the guts of earthworms many, many times. And he makes the case, which is now absolutely watertight, that without earthworms, there would be no civilization, because there could have been no farming. He makes the case that in the Middle East, which is now a desert, had once been rich with soil formed by earthworms. The soil washed away because we didn't preserve it. And that was a classic case of his ability to look sideways at a problem. Who could possibly care about earthworms, the world's most boring subject? Earthworms form politics. Darwin was the first to show that. If biology is a language, the theory of evolution is its grammar. You know, you can't learn a foreign language without understanding the grammar. You can't speak English. We don't speak English without understanding the grammar. We do it subconsciously. And what Darwin did was to point out to the biologists of the world, who may subconsciously have thought that there was some sense in what they were doing, although they had the idea wrong if it was a creationist one, to point out that there were grammatical rules, and these were the rules of descent with modification, the rules of evolution. And once he'd said that, the study of language, the language of life, became far, far easier. And now every molecular biologist, all my students, for example, who know nothing about evolution or so they think, every time they press the button on their DNA sequencing machine or put their data into a big protein database, they're actually studying Darwinian evolution. They're using the grammar of biology. I only wish they knew more about where it came from.
Finally, Gillian Beer, a former professor of literature at Cambridge University, on what Darwin himself read.
He kept reading lists from the late 1830s, when he got back from the Beagle, right through to 1858. So there we have a pretty thorough list of what he read, though even then he doesn't write down everything. One thing he does, which is very helpful to any later reader, is he says how he read it. So he'll say, skipped, or read thoroughly, or need not read again. So that his response all the time to the book that he's reading is there in the reading list as well. We know that he read novels all the way through his life. When he was a young student at Edinburgh, his family thought he was reading too many novels. When he was a much older man, Emma used to read to him, his wife, every afternoon. And when he'd lost all his other aesthetic senses in his own understanding of it, he said that the one thing that remained with him were fiction, and that he blessed all novelists, and that he loved almost all of them, as long as they didn't end unhappily, and then he says, against which a law ought to be passed. So alongside his reading of travels, his reading of every kind of scientific work, he's reading at large. He never sequesters his scientific thinking. It's all part of being alive. His style is a very interesting mixture of, at times, a quite rapturous description. His children used to tease him and say that when he described a barnacle, it sounded as though he was doing an advertisement for it. And at the same time, a close observation which misses no detail of the thing being described. And he thought himself that he had to write because he couldn't draw. Most botanical writers of the time could do very intricate pictures, but he said he could not do that. So he was driven to refining description. So there's a mix between extreme detail and then these large propositions, these theoretical ideas, and he moves to and fro in his style between these two quite different arcs, really, from one to the other.
That was our holiday mini Science Weekly. We'll be back in full form in 2 weeks, so come back to hear the full science team in action then. Next week, in another mini Science Weekly, you can hear Martin Rees musing the future of our planet. Remember, you can get all your science news at guardian.co.uk/science, and you can follow our tweets at twitter.com/guardianscience. This podcast was produced by Pascal Wise and Scott Corley. Until next time, I'm Alok Jha.